Hello and welcome. You're listening to me, Alice, on the Backtracker History Show podcast. Join me as we go delving through the archives to find out about people, places and events that happened in the past. These were stories that were big news in their day, but are largely forgotten now. Most of these podcasts have been specially edited from a Bradley Stoke radio show in Bristol, England. And one of the great things about this podcast is that I can go into more detail about each story because there are no time constraints. And it's really easy to show your support just by spreading the word, leaving reviews, and sharing with all your family and friends. It really does help. If you want to get in touch with me with show ideas, comments, or information, you can via Twitter or Facebook by using @BacktrackerUK with a capital B, capital T and a capital UK, or emailing me at info@backtracker.co.uk. Now, on with the show. The terrible event I'll be talking about this week occurred in the year 1920, and as always, we look at what else happened that year. Well, it was a time of unrest in the country. The Government of Ireland Act of 1920 was passed by the British Parliament and led to the partition of Ireland into Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. It aimed to address the ongoing Irish Home Rule crisis by creating separate parliaments for the two regions. There was also the Anglo-Irish War. The conflict between Irish nationalists and British forces continued to escalate in 1920. It was characterised by guerrilla warfare and reprisals by both sides. The violence eventually led to negotiations and the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty in 1921. We also had women's suffrage in 1920, when women in Great Britain had already gained some suffrage rights through the Representation of the People Act of 1918, which granted voting rights to women over the age of 30 who met certain property qualifications. However, full equality in voting rights was not achieved until the Representation of the People, or Equal Franchise Act of 1928, which extended voting rights to all women over the age of 21. We also had economic challenges. Like much of the world, Great Britain faced the challenges following World War I, and we had to deal with post-war reconstruction efforts, high unemployment, and inflationary pressures during this period. The aftermath of World War I also saw significant labour unrest in Britain. Workers demanded better wages, improved working conditions and greater political representation. There were numerous strikes and industrial disputes throughout 1920 as workers sought to assert their rights and improve their living standards. All these events helped shape the political, social and economic landscape of Great Britain in 1920 and contributed to the country's ongoing evolution during the interwar period. But the event we'll be talking about occurred on the 23rd of September 1920, after a Lance Corporal with the Royal Engineers travelled to Plymouth to persuade his sweetheart to marry him, and failed.
Word of the Week.
And this week's Word of the Week is sesquipedalian, which means given to or characterised by the use of long words. It's a term that's often used, quite humorously, to describe someone who tends to use overly long or complex words in their speech or writing. Cyril Victor Tennyson Saunders was a former Lance Corporal in the Royal Engineers and had a background of military service. After joining the army as a young boy, he served as a wireless operator in the North Russia Relief Force. Known for his positive demeanour and strong character, he later served as a regimental policeman in the camp at Crowborough at the time of the murder. There were many members of the Saunders family who were enlisted in the army. In fact, on the 29th of September 1900, John Saunders, Cyril and Dorothy's grandfather, received a letter from Queen Victoria and £3, congratulating him on his having 5 sons in the army. The youngest at the time was with the field forces in South Africa. Cyril had been in a relationship with his cousin, Dorothy May Saunders, nicknamed Bubbles, for 2 years, and they had plans to marry. Dorothy, who was just 1 month shy of 17, also had connections to the military. Her father, Captain Frederick George Saunders, had been an officer in the Indian Army, and the family were actually in Secunderabad, India, when Dorothy was born on the 24th of October 1903. Dorothy had been living with her father in St. Elmo, Onderman Road, until his death on the 10th of May 1920. Her mother had died on the 22nd of March 1916, and Dorothy had basically taken on the role of carer to her father, who was an invalid. When he died, though, she was given an inheritance, and she went into business in Plymouth with a cousin, running a small tobacconist and confectionery's shop at 30 Percy Terrace, Alexandra Road. After the tragic event and during searches, letters showed that in August 1920, Dorothy had feared that she was going to have a baby by Cyril after his last leave when they were together. However, in an undated letter postmarked the 20th of September 1920, which was found in her pocket, Dorothy talks about the suspected pregnancy.
"Dearest Cyril, I must tell you, even though it will break your heart, I don't feel at all now as though I can marry anyone. You have spoilt my trust in you, dear. Don't think, Cyril, there is any other boy, for there is not. If it's God's will that I must have a baby, I will let you know, but I must bear the brunt myself. Don't do anything rash, Cyril. Look after yourself, and please answer this. Yours, Bubbles."
It's worth noting that the autopsy revealed that Dorothy wasn't actually pregnant. The tone of Dorothy's letters to Cyril were quite gentle, but the same can't be said about his. His letters showed that he'd been jealous of Dorothy, apparently because she'd mentioned that on one occasion she'd been out with someone else. And on the 14th of September, he'd written a very threatening letter to her. By the time all these letters were floating backwards and forwards, it was quite obvious that Dorothy had made up her mind to not marry Cyril. Because when he turned up on the 22nd of September at the confectionery and tobacco shop in Plymouth, she greeted him with the remark,
"It is not a bit of good you're coming down here. Cyril, I am in the same mind."
Cyril had travelled from Crowborough Camp in Sussex, where he was stationed, deserting his post. Plymouth was their hometown, and he was on a mission hoping to mend the relationship. Cyril tried everything to persuade Dorothy to come back to him, and even threatened to commit suicide in front of her and her cousin, Mrs. Betty Lawrence, the cousin with whom Dorothy was working and staying with. Cyril said he would put his head in the line or fill his room with gas. Dorothy's cousin advised him not to do anything silly, saying,
"There's not only Bubble to consider, there's your mother. Won't you come back and have a cup of tea?"
And whilst they were sitting down, Mrs. Lawrence said kindly,
"Buck up and be a man. In a couple of months, you'll think of what a fool you've been."
It was at this point that Cyril burst into tears. However much he pleaded and begged, Dorothy refused to reconcile, though she did go with him to the movies and they even kissed each other when they parted for the night. Betty Lawrence allowed him to sleep that night in her spare room, whilst she and Dorothy shared a room. She'd later say that Cyril was acting quite odd, and she ended up staying awake most of the night.
Word on the street.
Today, we're going to Seawalls Road in BS9, Bristol, where, after a number of fatalities on the downs at Blackrock Quarry, John Wallace built a wall there in 1746. It was known as Wallace's Wall, but the name was later changed to Seawalls. The next day, after they had all breakfast together and Cyril had read the newspapers, he went out for a walk about 11 a.m. He then tried two gunsmith shops to purchase an automatic pistol. However, he found out that he had to get a permit first, and so at the second shop, he bought himself a sheath knife, which he took away. He then returned to Dorothy and her cousin at the shop at 30 Percy Terrace, Alexandra Road. Meanwhile, Dorothy had gone out, evidently to avoid seeing him, and her cousin tried to persuade him to return to his camp by an earlier train. But Cyril said he wanted to say goodbye to Dorothy first, and promised that he wouldn't harm either her or himself. Dorothy's cousin then went out of the field where she knew Dorothy would be walking, and they both returned. Mrs. Lawrence later said,
"They were quite friendly last night, and she told him that, though she did not intend to marry him, she would treat him just like the rest of the boys. He stayed here last night, and this morning went out for a walk alone, returning for dinner about 1 o'clock. Dorothy was not here when he returned, as she had gone for a walk through the fields to keep out of his way. He promised me faithfully and on his oath that if she came back, he would not lay a finger on her, and that neither would he do anything to himself. So I went to find her, and we returned to the shop together. Dorothy went into the shop to attend to somebody, and he went after her. After the customer left, they stood together with their backs to the counter for a long time, talking to each other."
It was then that Cyril drove the sheath knife 4 times through her left lung, 2 of the blows penetrating to the ribs of the back.
"Help! Help! Murder! Someone help! Murder! Get away from her, you brute!"
Later, during the court case, Betty Lawrence would say,
"I was in a room at the back of the shop at the time, and suddenly I heard her scream, 'Betty, Betty!' I thought at first that he was trying to strangle her, but then she screamed the second time, blood rushed out of her mouth, and I saw that he had stabbed her and she had collapsed. I went to try and interfere, but he pointed the dagger at me, so I shouted for help and rushed out of the side door. He simply went and stood in the doorway of the shop and lit a cigarette, remaining there until the arrival of the police. When they arrived, the man pointed to a blood-stained trench dagger lying in the room and admitted that he had stabbed the girl."
Meanwhile, in the house across the road, Private J.J. Boot was sitting reading a book at his upstairs window when he heard the screams. When he looked out, he could see the prostrate figure of Dorothy lying across the doorway of the shop opposite his building. He rushed to the scene and saw Cyril just standing there, watching as the blood was gushing from Dorothy's mouth. Cyril then turned to him and said,
"There's no use in your doing anything, because I have done her in. I have stabbed her through the heart."
Boot would later say,
"The soldier was very cool and collected. I said, 'What did you do it with?' And he replied with that, pointing to the bloody trench dagger on the counter. I said, 'I will take the knife for safety,' and I did take it over to my own house. I then telephoned for the police. On my return, the ambulance had arrived and answered to my summons, and they took the murdered woman away. I then said to the soldier, 'You better come over to my house and sit down until the arrival of the police.' He did as I suggested and sat smoking a cigarette. He told me he had been courting the girl for 2 years and she had thrown him over. Later he said,
'I am a deserter and I have run away with a lot of money.'"
When the George Street Ambulance Brigade arrived, it was quite evident that Dorothy had succumbed to her injuries and died. Her body was then taken to the mortuary, where it was kept until the inquest. At his trial, his only defence was one of insanity, based principally upon a blow on the head that Cyril had received on the 24th of July 1920 when trying to arrest a rioter at a camp whilst he was working in the army. However, the wound had in fact been a superficial one, and although Cyril was detained in hospital for some days, he was up and about playing rugby and football about 6 weeks afterwards. In court, witnesses talked of his changed manner after the injury, but that it was probably more likely that he had been a good deal worried at that time by the fear that Dorothy had been pregnant, and his jealousy that she might be seeing someone else. It was further noted that the prison medical officer found no trace of insanity or abnormality. Cyril Victor Tennyson Saunders was convicted with no recommendation of mercy. However, there were many applications on his behalf for a reprieve, with a large petition made up by house-to-house canvassing in Plymouth, which was noted for having been strongly objected to by one resident. A police report to the Home Office, in consideration of the possibility of a reprieve, made a list of comparable cases, which included ones where the person had been executed and reprieved, for reference. However, the police report concluded,
"This appears to me to be a particularly bad case. The prisoner had apparently seduced an innocent girl before or shortly after she was 16 years of age, and when it was not unnaturally borne in upon her that she would be unwise to marry him, he deliberately murdered her. I doubt if there was any use sending the petition to Lord Coleridge, but he should be consulted if there is any question of commuting the sentence. Personally, I think that girls in these circumstances should be afforded all the protection that the laws allow, and I think the sentence should be carried out."
The petition failed, and he was subsequently hanged in Exeter Prison by John Ellis and William Willis at 8 a.m. on November 30th, 1920. Witnesses said that he conducted himself with extraordinary self-possession. Outside the prison, a small crowd had gathered, standing in a row alongside the railway boundary and gazing up at the prison walls. There would be no black flag raised, as in previous executions, but as the bells tolled 8 a.m, every man's head was uncovered and remained that way until the clock stopped chiming. At 8:20 a.m, the wicket gate was opened by a warder, who placed a notice that the execution had taken place and that Cyril was dead. The notice read,
"Declaration of Sheriff and others. We, the undersigned, hereby declare that judgment of death was this day executed on Cyril Victor Tennyson Saunders in His Majesty's Prison of Exeter in our presence. Dated this 30th day of November 1920.
Before his execution, Saunders expressed gratitude to the prison staff in a letter to the governor, acknowledging their kindness during his confinement. It read,
"My dear Chief, I want to thank you and all the other officers who have had charge of me for the kindly consideration I have at all times received. I appreciate very deeply all of the kindness you have shown me. Will you be good enough to convey this message to your colleagues? Believe me, yours gratefully and sincerely, C.B. Saunders."
Hi, I'm Dietrich.
I'm Alex.
And I'm Ben.
We're from the podcast That Song From That Movie, the journey through the very best and worst of movie songs.
We want you to join us on our voyage across the cinematic sound waves as we take a deep dive on a new song and movie each week to figure out just what makes them tick.
Already we've set sail with Celine Dion on the Titanic, found a friend in Toy Story, and gotten drenched out in the rain with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Hopefully each breakdown allows us to answer the ultimate question of what's better, the movie or the song. Or at least learn something new along the way.
Just like learning that Toy Story 4 is a meaningless cash grab without a soul.
You can subscribe right now on all good podcast platforms, If you use one of the bad ones, then that's on you, and we can't be held responsible.
Subscribe to That Song from That Movie.
In the news today, a woman fainted onto the luggage carousel at Bristol Airport. Thankfully, she came round.
Back in the day facts.
And so we start with the 16th of March, 1792, when Denmark becomes the first nation to ban the transatlantic slave trade for financial reasons. This doesn't go into effect, though, until 1803, which causes a frenzy of activity amongst slave traders who even receive financial support. An estimated 120,000 enslaved Africans were transported from Africa to the West Indies aboard vessels flying the Dutch flag. On the 17th of March 1805, the Italian Republic, with Napoleon as president, becomes the Kingdom of Italy, with Napoleon as King of Italy. The 18th of March 1899, Phoebe, a satellite of Saturn, becomes the first to be discovered with photographs taken in August 1898 by William Henry Pickering. It's the biggest irregular satellite of Saturn, with a mean diameter of 213 kilometres, that's 132 miles. The 19th of March 1911 sees the first International Women's Day, with over 1 million men and women attending rallies in Austria, Denmark, Germany and Switzerland. Issues discussed include women's rights to vote and to hold public office, the right to work, to vocational training and an end to discrimination on the job. The 20th of March 1930, the American fast food restaurant chain KFC, or Kentucky Fried Chicken, is founded as Saunders Court and Cafe by Colonel Harlan Saunders in North Corbin, Kentucky. The 21st of March 1952 sees 20,000 attempt to attend the first rock and roll concert ever when Alan Freed presents the Moondog Coronation Ball at an old 12,000-seat Cleveland arena. Performers include Paul Williams and the Hucklebuckers, Tiny Grimes and the Rocking Highlanders, the Dominoes and Veretta Dillard. And lastly, on the 22nd of March 1957, Elvis Presley released his single All Shook Up. Ironically, an earthquake shakes San Francisco on the very same day. Well, I'm afraid that's it from me today. You've been listening to the Backtrack, a history show with me, Alice. And the people who really deserve my thanks are those that brought the story to life. And this week, they are Molly Jeffries, Steve Yeo, Sam Roberts and Joe Wilson from St. Stephen's Drama Group in Bristol, our very own Steve Shepherd from Bradley Stoke Radio and Rose Hills. Thank you, one and all. Thank you once again for listening to me, Alice, on the Backtracker History Show. If you'd like to get in touch with me, you can find me on Twitter or Facebook by looking up at Backtracker UK with a capital B, a capital T and a capital UK. I also occasionally post onto TikTok and Instagram. So do come along and find me because it's amazing to hear from you and get some feedback or even ideas for future shows. As a small independent podcaster, your help and support is always appreciated. And one way you can do that is to rate the show wherever you get your podcasts. Leaving a review also helps as it gives other people an idea of what the show's about. The show is regularly released on Mondays. So until next time, guys, take care and look after each other.